Hi, friends. Welcome to the By Faith Podcast. I'm your host, Christine Hoover, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week this season, I'm talking with a guest about how they're using their unique gifts and talents in their specific context and season of life. My prayer for you is that by listening, you'll be encouraged, challenged, and equipped to step out by faith using your particular gifts for God's glory. Friends, I'm creating much more than this podcast. I do a little microblogging on Instagram, actual blogging on my website, and I have a few books I've put out into the world. In fact, I recently turned in my manuscript for my fifth book, and I'd love for you to follow along with me so you can hear more about it as the time comes. You can find me on Instagram at ChristineHoover98, and all the books and all the things at my home online, gracecoversme.com. You can also head there if you ever need a link to anything I mention in the show, and you're going to want to get links today. I guarantee it. This episode is sponsored by The Good Book Company, publisher of Goodbye to Goodbyes, the latest addition to their beautifully illustrated, award-winning Bible storybooks for children. In this vivid, moving, and exciting retelling of the story of Lazarus, Lauren Chandler helps children understand that Jesus came to say goodbye to goodbyes forever. For more information about Goodbye to Goodbyes, go to thegoodbook.com. Today, my guest on the show is Amy Blair. Amy and her husband and kids live in Malaysia, and Amy is the founder and CEO of the Batik Boutique, which you'll hear about in the episode. I asked Amy to share her story of how she and her husband Ryan ended up in Malaysia and what it's like to live, serve, and lead cross-culturally. She shares what God has revealed about himself and in her through cross-cultural living and why she struggled with identity for several years there. Finally, Amy tells how practicing language of the friend one day changed her entire life and the lives of many women and children in Malaysia in what became the Batik Boutique. If you've ever noticed a problem and thought someone should do something about that, you will love hearing how Amy knew she was the person to do something about what she saw. Here, friends, is my conversation with Amy Blair. Hey, Amy, welcome to the By Faith Podcast.
Thanks, Christine. Happy to be here.
I'm really excited to get to talk to you because we know each other from a former life. It feels like a former life. Yeah. Back in when we were in college. We were in college together, right?
Yes, but then no, I only met you when Kyle first came to the church there.
Okay. So that's what I was wondering, if it was when you were a student or we were students together, because my husband was the college pastor at a church at A&M where you were a student. And I knew your husband from high school. And then he was a student. I guess he was still a student when we came back to the church.
Maybe. I think he was graduated.
Where was he?
Already. Because he's 4 years older than me. He was working in Michigan.
Okay. I don't remember that part.
But we met on a trip. There was this trip that was like a summer trip of all A&M students to Turkey. And that's actually how we met. That's how I met Ryan. And even though we were in the same university, because he was 4 years older, he had graduated already and was working and came back because of this alumni kind of trip. And that's how we met. So I didn't actually know Ryan in college. I only met him after he was in college and I was in college. Just happens we went to the same college.
Okay. I didn't remember that detail. I just remember how much you were in love with him. And I was like,
I was.
This is a guy I know from high school. He's young. He was younger than me. I can't remember. Maybe 3 years younger than me. So I just remember him as this little guy running around in the band hall because we were in band together. And you were like, I'm so in love with Ryan. I know I'm going to marry him. I'm like, okay. I mean, he was always a great guy, but I always thought him as like this little brother guy, you know? And then you were like, I know I'm going to marry him. And you did.
I did marry him. And I did know.
It just took him a while to come around and realize.
Like 5 years, a while. So yeah.
Did y'all start were you dating during those years or just friends?
No.
Or
I don't. We were friends first. And that's when I was madly in love with him. And then we went on a couple of dates at one point when his parents were in Dallas and I was at A&M. And so when he would come in town, we like went to dinner and kind of, you know, very casual things. And then he ended up moving to Afghanistan, as you do.
And of course
he was working. I know. But you know that that's totally him, right? So to do the most out of the box thing that no one else will do.
Exactly.
So that's him. And then he was working there for 2 years. And so we had like, he says we kept in touch. I say we virtually had no contact, but you know, and then he came back and looked me up. But at that point I was already like, oh, we tried to date that time. It didn't work out. He moved as far away in the world as he could from me. So how would this ever happen?
Yeah.
And I had kind of given up on that reality and dream that I thought, oh, this is the one. And then he looked me up then and we reconnected. And yeah, actually at the time I was dating someone else and he was basically like, no, well, I'll just wait for you. So it kind of, our scenario switched then. And he was a bit more adamant on we will be together thing. And I was like, really? So it was, and it did. And I think 3 months later we got engaged and 3 months after that we got married.
Wow.
Yeah. So the first of that year, like if you had told me the first of that year, by the end of this year, you will be married to the man of your dreams that you thought like is a lost cause and is never going to happen. I would be like, I'm sorry, what? And actually, really, that happened.
Well, I'm so glad it happened. I mean, I remember when you said that to me, you were coming to me, I think, because you knew I knew him. Like, what do I do here? I'm glad it worked out because I always thought, you know what? I could see it. I could see it happening between the two of you. But I'm wondering when he came to you that day, or he came to you and you're dating this other guy and he says, I'm going to wait for you. That had to have been like a crisis of.
Yeah. But I kind of, it was one of these things where this other guy didn't even live in the same city. And I kind of like knew that that really wasn't, I was in a weird season of life where I was just kind of like, okay. But I kind of already knew in my heart, apart from Ryan, that my husband, that this guy wasn't the one.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. But I hadn't done anything about it to like end it. Yeah. And I didn't actually end it at first because at this point I was adamant that, oh no, I've already waited 5 years ago that I thought you were my husband. So I'm not going to rush things now just because you showed up from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a girl in like 2 years. So, I did make him wait a little while.
I needed to
sort out my own, because I also knew if I was going to open my heart up to him in particular, again, in that situation, that like, it was all or nothing for me at that point. So I needed to cautiously walk into that one.
And it was all or nothing.
All or nothing. That's kind of how we do it.
So when you got married, was he back from Afghanistan or what happened after y'all got married? Cause I think that's when I kind of lost track of you.
Right. Yeah. Cause we weren't living anywhere near each other, I think, at that point. So he had planned to just come back for like a few months to kind of have like a rest and sort of regroup. And I think was generally open considering to maybe going back there. And then we got together. So that really wasn't a good option to move to Afghanistan right away when you're newlyweds and like, you know. So we stayed in Dallas for a while. I was working there for a ministry actually, and then an NGO there. And so we connected, and then we knew, and we had good mentors and people that knew us both separately as singles and then also now married. So that was really cool that we were kind of surrounded with some people further along in life than us who knew us both individually. So that was for about a year we stayed there. And then we had an opportunity to move to Connecticut, and we actually moved to Connecticut for a little less than a year to help another NGO open that was partnering with Yale, like Divinity School in Connecticut. So we helped some friends open a nonprofit there and really loved it. And I think that was a good experience for us because it was the first time that now we as the couple went and did something a little bit cross-cultural. I know you understand that.
Yeah.
Because the Northeast was just different than the South. Yeah. It was different than Texas. And right. So that was a good kind of like trial time for us before we moved to a foreign country. Because, you know, we had to adapt to somewhat of a new culture. We had to now as a couple, like establish our own friendships and our own routines apart from all of our safety nets of relationships that we had grown up with. So I think I really valued that season. It was great, a great time for us. And then we moved to Malaysia after that.
So when you got married, did you guys already know that some sort of overseas living or missions oriented, was that in your future always? You talked about that from the beginning?
Yeah, I think the difference is we both on our own, when we were single, we were both doing things globally as just world Christians. So I had traveled a lot in the Middle East and worked with churches in the States, like helping people engage with other cultures and you know, in different faiths. And then Ryan had worked at an NGO. He's an engineer by background, and he had worked doing development work for an all local, like, Muslim NGO in Afghanistan. And that was a really, we both had really good experiences individually. So it was interesting when we got together, it was a little backwards how most people do it. Like, I remember the first night we actually had like a real date, because we had had so many serious conversations about calling and about what these deep things were doing with our life. And we had connected at this spiritual level, but I was like, what's your middle name? You know, and he's like, what's your favorite food? You know, and like, actually, do we just enjoy each other? Do we like to be around one another? Because I felt like most of our friendship, even in relationship, was pretty intense before that. So yeah. we kind of already knew that we had that connection and calling and like life purposes, but it was like, but do I actually want to do that with you? You know, like, do we want to be together doing that? So, but obviously 3 months later, we had pretty much figured that out. So.
Yeah. So you had figured it out yourself before that. I would love to kind of hone in on that and hear from you how you knew that God was calling you. What would you say your calling is, and what did you know when you were younger and you were single, and how did you know that that's what God was calling you to do? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think, you know, I grew up as a good Southern Baptist. And so I think that my appreciation I have in my parents and my family is, and of just the Baptist denomination in general, I think is a really good understanding of the Bible and of God's bigger picture in the Bible, and how it's a story of weaving, you know, it is God's redemptive plan of creation from the beginning to the end. And so I had a lot of that, whether I followed principles in the Bible or not, you know, is a question to ask at different periods of life, probably, but in growing up years, I'll put it that way. And but I knew, you know, I had the foundation and the beliefs just from my parents and my upbringing. And so I'm like forever appreciative of that. I feel like that is the heritage that they've left for me, and, you know, that we're leaving for our kids too. So then it was my father actually took me to Guatemala when I was a teenager on this medical trip, where we helped people in villages have eyeglasses. And I think as a teenager, that was really eye-opening for me. I mean, I didn't own a passport. I'm from a small town in Texas, and we didn't, you know, we went to Florida as like as far as we ever went, right? So I think my father taking me and exposing me to another culture, it was a huge part of my story. Mm-hmm. So much so that when I was moving to the other side of the planet, and he was not happy about that.
Oh, no.
I reminded him of how he was the first one who took me out of my comfort zone. And then I think that was key, that exposure to another culture was key at a younger age. And then my background of just the Bible and church and good teaching. And then when I was at Texas A&M, I was just extremely thankful for the people that God put in my life, you know, even down to Kyle and you know, pastors, and then the roommates and friends I had, and was a great time for me of just processing, as a lot of university students do, right? It's like, what's my purpose? What am I going to do with my life? Like, what do I want to be about? And again, I ended up on this trip that we went to Turkey, and that's actually where I met my husband, which was amazing. And then I had actually struggled a season in college with depression and anxiety, and it was a new thing for me. It's not anything I had any family history of or had. I didn't actually even have any real reason. You know, even when I went to see a counselor to try to talk through, I couldn't ever get to the root of it at the time. And so that was difficult for me. And it was the timing of that mixed with when I went on a trip to Turkey, that God had done a lot of healing in my life. And I think for the first time, I realized how many people in the world don't have access to experience the healing that can come through Christ. And it's literally because they've not heard. And yet how me hearing, you know, I don't know, thousands of times maybe, and still I was struggling. And that was with me coming from a background where I was rich in the opportunity to know Christ. And so it just really impacted me. I think that was just life-changing, that experience as well, was the trip that just like solidified for me, oh, okay, everything I thought I was living for actually is irrelevant. You know, I want to, no matter what I do for a career, you know, I don't think it means everybody needs to drop what they're doing and join mission agencies. I don't think that's the only option. But I do think that it's whatever we're doing, you know, it should be for the kingdom, and it should be globally for the kingdom.
Mm.
So that was where that conviction started. And it's just kind of been working its way.
Yeah.
Working its way to fruition. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you and Ryan got married and y'all were talking about what you wanted to do going forward, how did you end up in Malaysia?
Yeah. So we thought, so Ryan had been in Afghanistan and I had traveled several places in the Middle East. And I think I would say, and I loved Turkey even. So I think if it was just up to us, that's, we would have gone somewhere that was either like Farsi speaking, because he had already invested in learning another language, or somewhere in our own liking or preference would have actually been the Middle East. And it's funny because I had traveled, I think I counted at the time, I think it was like 17 countries or something, right, at this point, which was a lot for like a, you know, 23-year-old or something. Yeah. But and of all the places I ever traveled, one time I had come to Malaysia to for a summer, and it was the one place I said I never wanted to move. Yeah.
Of course.
And yeah, right. This, you know, everybody has this story somewhere. But it was because I remember it was so hot and humid. It was like Houston all over again.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was like, everyone is short here and I'm tall. And then I didn't like the clothes that they wore. Like, this is all very deep stuff, I know. I did not like their clothes. I actually didn't really like the food. It was either really sweet, like drinks and all, and I didn't drink sweet drinks, or it was just tons of carbs, and like, no girl wants to live. I mean, I want to live in a place with all carbs, but like, my body does not like if I just eat carbs, right?
Uh-huh.
So I just was sitting here thinking, I'm sweaty. I'm like, I don't like this. And I cannot blend in for anything. Like, it is obvious when I come walking down the street. So why do I want to live there? And here we are. So what happened was, there was an opportunity, I think, because we were new in our marriage, we made decisions a bit differently at the time, because we knew that it was most important if we wanted to live globally and internationally for a long season. I think we had some good mentors in our life who helped us understand that we needed other people in our life to do it with. But this is not something, you know, you don't become super spiritual just because you moved far away. In fact, whatever struggles, issues, things you haven't dealt with, actually, when you put yourself in a foreign country, they get magnified and it will just come out like really ugly. So we knew, being pretty much newlyweds, that we probably needed some love. And so there was a couple that knew us both single that were mentors of ours, that were part of our wedding and all. And they were married with four kids, younger children, different season of life ahead of us. And they had an opportunity to go to Malaysia to work in a tourism company. And that was actually my minor, was tourism management back in the day. And so we were like, they invited us one day. They said, they literally called us. We were living in Connecticut. This is how spiritual this was. They called us and go, hey, what are you guys doing? And we're like, well, actually, we just finished this, our work with this nonprofit. We're not really sure. What are you doing? And they're like, we're going to move to Malaysia. Do you want to come? And we laughed and said, no, like, what? Remember, we don't like it there. So, and they pulled the, oh, why don't you pray about it thing? And we're like, okay, sure. But no, we really weren't going to pray about it. And then actually we were like, well, wouldn't it be kind of cool to go with them? You know, like, if we were going to go anywhere, this isn't our plan at all. But it would be really neat at this season of our life to be with a family who's known us, and like, we could support them and they could support us. And so we made the decision relationally. And I will say it's the best decision I think we could have made at the time. Yeah. We had a really great experience with him. Yeah.
And
they've since moved back to Texas or to the US. But
so when you were going, what was the purpose for you? Were you working jobs in Malaysia, or how did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
So every place like this, you have to, in this part of the world, in Malaysia, 65% Muslim, it's the main religion here. And then we've got Chinese, which would be Buddhist, and then Indian, which are Hindus. So we've kind of got a melting pot of a lot of these major world religions. And you need to have a reason, like, you need to work especially at our ages and life stage, you need to contribute to the economies you're going. So at first, we wanted to also study language because we wanted to connect with people like in their heart language. And so we knew that would take some time. So Ryan actually signed up to do an MBA here. So we were able to be students under that. And then I learned language. And then I was working some for a tourism company as well here. And so that was what we did at first. Mm-hmm. And originally we thought we would just come for a couple of years. You know, we didn't have any kids yet. We were newly married. Like, why not? You know, yeah. We can always come back to our quote normal life later kind of thing. Yeah. So now it's been 12 years.
Well, I would love to hear as you're, you know, that what you said earlier about things being revealed as you put yourself in these kinds of situations, a lot of things come to the surface. I would love to hear what those first few years, what God did in your life, what did he show you? Mm. What did he teach you about yourself, but also about the world and about what he's doing?
Yeah. Yeah. I think at first it was because both of us knew we wanted to live cross-culturally single. It was interesting. People would tell us, and we had like prepared ourselves for the worst. You know, everybody's like, it's going to be so awful. You know, you don't have this and you don't have that. And so I think we almost went into it like, if anything was good, we were like pleasantly surprised, right? Mm-hmm. And then the reality was, because we had both longed and God had put this in our heart, you know, separately and together to do this, it was pleasantly, surprisingly like easy for us at first. And it was good. And, you know, once we actually got here, we were actually, you know, we were loving learning a language. I loved it because my degree was in communication and I love like cross-cultural communication was my favorite course. And so here I'm like living it out for real. So I like thrived in it. And so we made lots of local friends and we learned, we wanted to eat what they ate. We dressed how they dressed. We talked how they talked. Like we were just like, teach me everything, like a sponge. And I think that was just God's grace in our life because that foundation that we had has carried us through, a lot of hard times, you know, that have come because we've been very connected to where we are and been kind of fully there. You know, there's that saying, wherever you are, be all there. Mm-hmm. And that was important part of our adapting. Mm-hmm. So for me in those early years, one of the things that I wasn't like expecting, I didn't know what happened is in the culture here, when people get married, it's extremely important to prove your fertility like right away. Yeah. Ooh. But no one told, I mean, you don't read this stuff in a book. So no one tells you this until one day, like, cause we're a young married couple and people would talk to us like, oh, where are you from? That's just, how long have you been married? I mean, these are the normal questions. And the third question is, do you have any kids? And mm-hmm. I mean, I was only like 27 or something, you know? Mm-hmm. And I innocently am like, no. You know? And then they're like, why not? And I'm like, because we haven't been married very long. But I realized if you had been, this is the point we've been married like 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. If you had been married more than 1 year and you hadn't fell pregnant yet, then there was like concern now in the neighborhood about you as a woman. And of course it was always like as a woman, like it would be my problem if we weren't.
Right.
Yeah, so. So I was catching on to all of this and it started, that was one of these things that started causing me to question like myself and my identity. Am I like, am I supposed to be pregnant now? You know,
yeah.
Like, is this normal? And like all of these, we call them aunties, like all of the older ladies, everyone's like a family member here, even if they're not really your family, you call them auntie and uncle. And so all of the aunties, they would come whenever I would meet them, they would try to give me tips or like ask me what I was eating or like, have I tried this? Okay. Like, it's just awkward to me because we just wouldn't talk like this to people.
Right.
And then they started giving Ryan, the men started giving Ryan this special like 3-in-1 coffee that had special herbs in it that were going to help us or something. And we were just like, thank you, I think. And then, but those kind of interactions, the differences in the culture, you know, they're funny now, but at the time it was what started setting me off a bit to like go on this journey of who am I? Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest thing that happened in me for years, I mean, I think honestly, it took me between 5 and 7 years. That's a long time to come to terms with who am I? And because I felt like when I was there, when I first went there, I was trying to be like all things to all people, you know, and the verse goes, so as to win some, right? So I was thinking, I need to dress like them, eat like them, talk like them so that I'm not a stumbling block and they can see Christ and all these things. And so it's all good and noble and good intentions, right? But I realized along the way it's a real struggle on your identity because everything I knew every way I knew to be Amy, this person who loves God, who has friends, who, you know, does this for a living or whatever, however you define yourself, everything I used to define myself in didn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And it wasn't an option. So that same Amy who worked for an NGO there, that NGO doesn't exist in Malaysia. And, mm-hmm. you know, nobody knew any, I had no history there and no, you know, so people only, they saw me through a different lens. They saw me mm-hmm. through Hollywood. They saw me through, you know, whatever they thought about an American. I mean, they mm-hmm. all think I'm a cowgirl, which is funny because I don't think I'd ever ridden a horse at that point in my life. But
but you are from Texas.
I am from Texas. I will own it. Don't you worry. And they all knew about J.R. Ewing. And I was like, yeah. I'm sorry. Like my mom used to watch that.
Right.
And I remember seeing it on Saturday night sometimes, like, you know. So it was a real unraveling experience for me. And it's very uncomfortable. And I didn't like it because I felt like I didn't know who to be. And I felt like for years, like there was this Amy that I was trying to be in Malaysia. She was like the Malaysia Amy. And then when I, and it was 2 years before we came back to see our family, which was the longest. I mean, I like saw my grandmother and cousins every weekend of my life growing up. So coming from that background to like no contact at all. And in the meantime, I had also had our first child. So I became a mother, which is already an identity thing as well to go through. Okay, who am I now as someone's mother? But doing all of that in a foreign context without your family or anything familiar to you at all is a very exposing and painful process. So that my journey was about coming to who does God say I am, a complete tearing down of everything I thought was there. But it's been the most beautiful thing that's ever happened to me because mm-hmm. the way he restores and the way he puts me back together. Actually, I told someone at this dinner tonight, it's great. I think it took me about 7 years to come to terms with, okay, this is who Amy is. And this is Amy wherever she is. Like mm-hmm. this is Amy in Malaysia. You want to put Amy in Europe. She's there too. You want to go back to Texas, whatever. Like, I feel like through all of this like sanctification and processing that God has reconciled my identity in him to be consistent, like through all places. And that's really like, I'm very deeply grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Is it disorienting for you to go home now, to go to Texas and to be in the US? I mean, do you feel like you have two homes or do you feel like Malaysia's home? You know, that,
yeah, there's this concept. I mean, also it took me longer than it takes some people that I hear. Like, I do feel like this is home now. So mm-hmm. When we talk about home, I actually am referring to my home in Malaysia. Like for the first, I mean, that took me, I mean, 7-8 years for sure. Yeah. Some people get there faster. It just took me a long time because I'm proud of being from Texas and I like my home. So that one took a lot longer. Now what's interesting is, I love both places. I love the people in both places. They're very different and I love things about both places. So it's a bit strange to kind of love two places, you know, like that are completely on opposite sides. I mean, you can't get much further than Malaysia. Like we are 14 hours ahead of Texas. Like that's literally on the other side of the planet, you know, really you cannot get much further than this. So,
yeah.
So that's, I think the hardest part is just that, like, I always wish that Malaysia was in like, you know, Cancun or something. Like I would easily live there. I would live in Malaysia forever. If I could like pick it up and if I could relocate it by Texas, I would be here forever.
Yeah.
Or if they would open up a Target, which doesn't seem to want to happen. So,
I don't even think about stuff like that. I've never lived overseas.
Or like Chick-fil-A. But, I mean, like, hello. Yeah. Like, if Chick-fil-A would open, I'd stay forever. But
yeah. Okay. So you've been there 12 years. And
yeah.
When you first came, you were learning language. Tell us what happened after that. What keeps you there?
We moved to the capital. We started our family. So our first son was born in the city. We lived on a little island, actually, and he was born there. And then we ended up moving to the capital. Because there's more job opportunity as well, like for Ryan at the time, just in the bigger city. And that he started working and I was staying at home for a while with our son. He was one at the time. And then it was in that time when we moved to the city, I also like had to start over again because it was 4 hours away from where we lived before. And so I didn't have the same relationships anymore. Mm-hmm. There was an IKEA, so that was life changing for me to go buy furniture and places where things could be like assembled and put together. So that was a benefit. So we moved to the city, and I met a few ladies who lived like 5 minutes down the road from me, one of whom was a single mom. And she came around to my house asking if I had any extra work that she could do. But being a good, you know, strong woman who was determined to prove that she could do everything by herself, from my Southern roots, it's like really difficult to think I would need help with something right in my house. Like, that is my domain. Plus, since I wasn't working, all the more reason I had no reason to, quote, need help. So I asked her, maybe she could come over. I just wanted adult interaction. I mean, can anybody with a toddler understand that? Sometimes you just need to have a conversation. And so I said, would you come over and just talk to me? And like, we can drink tea and talk about, like, can you teach me language a bit? Just like as a friend, like just informally. So she started coming over every afternoon. And as my language progressed from talking with her, obviously our friendship progressed. And it was then that I began understanding her struggles as a single mom. And the reality was, myself as a new mom, that obviously touched my heart. And I was thinking, you know, she had problem after problem after problem. And I was thinking, okay, what's something I can do to practically help her? And so I began saying things like, can you bake? Or can you cook? Can you come over and cook dinner for us? We'll pay you to come make our dinner. Or come, you know, if you bake cookies, I can sell them to my friends. Or, you know, these kind of things. So just as a lot of women have started this kind of thing like this. So she tried to bake and it wasn't very good. And she cooks. She cooks. But I realized, like, Asians don't bake. They don't even have an oven. So, like, they stir fry. So, like, if you want to deep fry a banana, it's awesome. But if you want to bake a cake, like, no. So again, it was my background of what I thought was normal and hers were just very different. Right.
Yeah.
So then I was like, can you cook? And we always laugh because Ryan is like the most like flexible person in the world. I mean, he's so easy to please, especially with like food. He'll tell me thank you if I put him a sandwich on a plate, you know, like he is just appreciative of all things and not picky. And so my friend, her name's Anna, she was coming over to help cook for us. And finally he said to me a few days later, he's like, Amy, can you teach her how to do something else? Because everything's just, it's all stir fry. And it's like all, it's like a brown sauce or a red sauce. Like every day we're having like rice with a brown sauce or a red sauce. And he's like, it just tastes the same. So I realized that maybe we didn't have a future in, you know, running a restaurant or a bakery. And that's when I began asking her, well, what else can you do? So, she ended up telling me she had a sewing machine. And so that's where this all started, because she had this really old, like foot pedal, non-electric, like it probably half worked, like excuse of a sewing machine. And I knew nothing about sewing. But from my background in tourism, I knew that there was this traditional fabric called batik that is made in this region of the world. It's in Malaysia and Indonesia, and it's a wax resist dye method fabric. And I knew that that was like what Malaysia was known for, like in a souvenir gift kind of industry. Mm-hmm. And I also knew from my work before that there was a gap in the market here locally to buy a quality produced souvenir that was made locally. Like they were either imported in from Indonesia or even China, like, and they were machine printed and not authentic. And it always bothered me because I wanted to buy something local to like take back to give to my family or friends. And I kept running out of options. But yet when I went to Indonesia, or I went to Thailand or every neighbor of ours, basically, they had like, we had the same crafters and artisans here, but there was just a poor delivery. So I knew that like, I always thought in my head that like someone should do something about that. Do you ever have that thought? You see that and you're like, oh, somebody should do something. Like somebody should make an app for that or somebody. Uh-huh. So that was my, somebody should do something about it. And then I sort of realized that I didn't know that that meant it was going to be me to do something about it. So that's how we started. We started in the early days. Basically, they lived, Anna and friends of hers, they live in the low-income flats that's government subsidized. It's like the ghetto. It was 5 minutes down the road from me, but like, you know, years behind in all things. There are children, you know, who weren't going to school because they didn't have shoes. And I was just like, this is the capital city in like 2000 and something. Like, how can this be, you know? And yeah, and like kids just malnourished and no electricity in places, a lot of single mothers with 5 to 7 children living in 2-bedroom flats. And I was just overwhelmed with the need. And back to my story of the other times, like in Guatemala and then in Turkey, whenever I saw this, God just really spoke to me. And the message he's given me throughout all of this is, what's in your hands? So like with Anna, what was in her hands was a sewing machine. I mean, I tried to put an oven in her hand and that didn't work. we tried to make bread stir fry, but that didn't work. So what's in her hands was this minimal skill, but it's what she had to offer. And, you know, I just had what was in my hands was just the willingness to try to learn language, to communicate, to think, how can I do something to help her? And so what started from a friendship and of just literally, what do you have to work with? Then God's taken that and multiplied it in a lot of ways. So,
yeah, well, yeah, that's an understatement, it seems. You've basically created a business in Malaysia.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about the business and where it is today?
Yeah. So our name is Batik Boutique, and we are a social enterprise here in Malaysia. And we're an award-winning social enterprise as well. We've received awards from the government here. We've grown from literally, we started manufacturing in individual women's flats, like in their apartment, with whatever kind of thing they had. So now we run a sewing center within walking distance from the flats, like a proper center where we offer free sewing training to any woman who lives in poverty in a low demographic area there. And we've used part of the profits of our business to offer the training. And then we also, women who want to take on work can also work with us. So we provide a community. We teach financial literacy. We teach English classes. And we create jobs and skill sets for women to make gifts and souvenirs and more recently also apparel. And then and it's all made from this hand-dyed textile. So we partner with batik artists also all over the country. And they're more like family run businesses in the villages. And so we provide sustainability for them as well and income. And then we sell the products online worldwide in a boutique. We're opening our second and third boutique this year in Malaysia. And then a big part of what we do for just sustainability is we do corporate gifts, like premium gifts. So we do like events, conferences, like even globally. So we do subscription boxes in the US. If you've ever ordered from like Fairtrade Fridays, we're one of their vendors. We've produced for brands like Raven and Lily, doing apparels with them, the silk apparels that they've run. So that's, it's really cool because it's not a glamorous thing at all. Like I started the company in my house. Like my first two employees used to come work at my house. I mean, that's how glamorous we were. But we would get like magazine coverage and I'd be like, oh no, please don't come to my house. Like, I cannot. Where do you want to meet? You know?
So, yeah.
And then, you know, we started that way because again, it's what's in your hands. And all that was in my hands was the extra room in my house. So that's where we started. But I mean, I feel like we're nothing glamorous to see. I mean, the women also live in the flats and they walk over and, you know, to this like old shop lot, but we're small, but we're mighty. And we're seeing women's lives change. We're seeing women whose kids weren't going to school, they're going to school. Medical issues that have been able to be addressed. Every woman who works with us has opened a bank account, which none of them had one before.
Wow.
Women, you know, we've had our first seamstress bought her own car, which is pretty cool to see that she was empowered to even like drive, number one, but two, purchase her own vehicle. So they all buy smartphones. That's the first thing they buy for some reason. It's really funny. As soon as they get any money, they buy a smartphone. So that's what they do.
Well, I was in College Station maybe a year or two ago, and I was in one of the local stores there that's locally owned, and I saw your products there.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what Outfitters. Really, what'd you say?
It's at Aggieland Outfitters.
Yes, there, that's where I saw it. And I was so excited. I was like, I know her. I almost like did the elf, you know. I know her. I was so proud. And I know that you had started that, but I didn't realize, I guess, how much it had grown. And just when I saw that, I was so thankful that the work that you're doing. And that really kind of got me interested in talking with you even today. But I would love to hear what you have learned in this whole process about yourself again and about what God is capable of doing.
Yes. Well, I'll start with God because, you know, in the Bible, it says that he's able to do more than we can ask or imagine. Mm-hmm. And I think there's so many times, I mean, my prayers are not very spiritual or even long-winded most of the time. They're usually God help. Like, it's like, just help, help. There's so many times I don't know what to do. There's so many times. I mean, okay, let me break this down for you. I moved to a foreign country. I sound like a four-year-old when I speak language, you know, I'm sure of it. And then I've started a family. I have three kids. They're 10, 8, and 2. So add that to
me. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Surprise. And then you know, I've never run a business. I have no background in business. I have never designed. I don't sew. I don't know anything about social media or marketing. Like, and here I am now, like, every day put in a situation. It's one thing to be an entrepreneur. That's hard already. Like, anywhere in the world, it's difficult. There's risk involved. There's constant decision making. You never know if you're doing the right thing or if it's the best thing. But then being a social entrepreneur is another level, because in an enterprise, you need to, the main P that's involved is profit. It's all numbers at the end of the day. If it's a viable, you know, solution to some problem, that's a business, if it works or not. But with a social enterprise, you need to be concerned about the profit, because we run sustained on just our business side. It's not an NGO or a charity. So we're is equally concerned about the business and the profit.
Okay.
Because the business and the profit funds the social side of what we do. So the programs we offer, also every time we take somebody on, we promise them sustainability. We promise if you put in your hours, we have work for you. Mm-hmm. So that's very scary to take the risk to say, like, I don't know, but do we, God? Like, do we have work for them? Like, because manufacturing is a very tricky industry. So I also knew nothing about manufacturing, right? I never manufactured anything in my life. So manufacturing is very volatile in terms of sales. Like, unless you have long-term partners, like if you're an apparel company who sews for, you know, H&M or one of these big brands and you do seasons with them, it's different because you know when the orders are coming and you plan your production around it. But when you do gifts in an industry that, you know, doesn't necessarily always repeat the same things, it's not by seasons. It's very volatile in terms of sales. And so it's hard to have predictability. So all of those things, plus I live in a developing nation. So like right now, my elevator at my office doesn't work and hasn't, and my landlord won't fix it. And there's nothing for me to make him fix it. So these things that you don't realize in the West, you take for granted because you don't know, you know, you just don't know that the rest of the world lives like this. Like, so trying to do a creative business with people living in poverty and artisans living in villages to cater to corporates and to Western people with high expectations is like complicated, much less doing it while you're raising a family, living cross-culturally and like on like a penny, you know, kind of thing. So the challenges are like enormous, not to mention just the social side when someone's husband gets jealous because now she's successful. Like, I didn't even know that was a thing, you know, until we hit a certain, I mean, it's progress. We hit a certain point where women were providing for themselves and their children, and that bothered people. So then, you know, other things happen from that. So there's just, it's like, if there's not one thing, there's three more and, you know, lots of layers to this onion and all of that. So, the good side of that is it gives you lots of opportunity to trust God. The scary side of that is like, literally, like, I just have never needed God so much. So I think I have, I wasn't aware that I really always needed God so much, because when I lived in America, my life was very safe. And I was more of a risk taker of my friends anyway. I mean, that's one of the reasons my husband and I even connected, because we were always that one friend who was going to like push you to your limit to go do something, you know?
Yeah.
So, but there, it's just a whole new level here. Like, it's like no crutch, no rug. It's all pulled out from under you. So now what? And so I've learned with God that he is more than able to do everything and beyond, you know, whatever we can think or imagine. And at the same time, like, I've learned a different patience with, and persevering, actually, like a long suffering, like to know what it means to be long suffering is a new thing for me in this life here, because he doesn't always do all the things that we think he should or that we ask him to do, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm in a place where like nobody's a believer and like everybody needs God. And so the depravity, it's pretty. It's very pretty where I live. And it's modern, like in the sense that we have Starbucks and huge shopping malls and it looks really wonderful. But as soon as you scratch the surface on that, it's like, it's just really in need of God. And so growing up in the South, I grew up with a lot of Christians. So all of these mm-hmm. things are so opposite of everything I've ever known. And that's where God's ministered to me is I used to be very results-based, like as an American in particular, I like to see results. I like to think I had something to do with results. Like I kind of consider myself a pretty capable, smart, like hardworking person. And in general, I never struggled to like make things happen. Like I worked hard and got good results. Like I thought that's what life was about. Yeah. If you just put your effort in, you will get this. And mm-hmm. if people weren't getting that, it's because they weren't putting their effort in or something, you know? It was all very, my gospel was very me and man centered of performance yeah. and, mm-hmm. and hard work, if that makes sense. So mm-hmm. I work really hard here and all, and no results happen. So, you know, that's been a humbling process to see that there's, God can do anything he wants at any given time for any reason. Like, right. I mean, I completely believe in this, but, if he's not, that doesn't make him any less. It doesn't make me any less either. And so I've seen my maturity has really happened in seeing a mentor of ours told us before we moved here that God wants to do more in you than through you. And I just thought that was rubbish. I was like, my good 25-year-old self was like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, well, maybe with you, he did, but
right.
I'm really capable. Watch
yeah.
this.
Right. I'm going to change the world. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And then I can't even like say, hello, how are you? You know?
like, yeah, exactly.
You can't really change the world yet. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is such a good, that's a really good word, Amy, because yeah. I've experienced the same thing. I haven't moved cross-culturally. I moved semi-cross-culturally from Texas yeah. to Virginia, but God has done more in me, I think, than he's yeah. ever used me. And I'm thankful for that. And I think that's a truth for service. When we step out and we serve God in some way, a lot of times what he does is show us our own hearts and our need for him and changes the motivation for why we're serving in the yeah. process.
But we wouldn't change it, right? Like it's that whole,
no.
I didn't know I was signing up for this part. Like I didn't mean to sign up for this. Yeah. Like it wasn't intentional, but yeah. Obviously God knows what he's doing.
Yeah. So where does the gospel play out in this work? Do people yeah. know that you are a Christian? Is that something, I don't know how it is as far as the country and how that's looked upon to be openly Christian, but do you have opportunities through this to share with the women who are working and sewing to share the gospel with them? How does that work?
Yeah. So, it's fine that I'm a Christian. I mean, I'm an American from the West. It's assumed that I'm a Christian, whether I'm one or not. So, it's fine. The government, it's very different depending on which people you're talking about here, because, certain different groups of people are not like, it's actually illegal to try to proselytize. It's all these things. So, yeah. So there's no issue with me being a believer. And I find it quite refreshing because we have all this diversity, you know, we've got Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, a few Christians and agnostic, you know, whatever. So, on one level, they're very tolerant individually. So like government wise is a different topic, you know, you cannot things, but individually I find the people, very tolerant of individual faiths. Like they're happy to like listen to what you believe or talk in that, but there's this interesting, I've never seen anywhere like this in all the places I've traveled. There's this segregation that's related to race and ethnicity and religion is like one. Okay. And there's like no question. So if you're Indian, you're a Hindu. If you are Chinese, Malaysian, you are if you're Indian, Malaysian, you're Hindu. If you're Chinese, Malaysian, you are Buddhist. If you're Malay, Malaysian, you are Muslim. And like, there's no question like okay. that you would ever be anything else. And technically speaking, you can't be like according to the law. So, Yeah, it's just strange because even I think coming from the West, we still question a lot more the whys behind something. And in this region of the world in the East, those like creative thinking is not something encouraged even from the time that people are small. So you would be surprised. It's just shocking to me coming from the West again, like saying like you've never thought, why are you this? You know, like I thought even growing up, I mean, I come from this strong Christian family. So like basically to be Texas is to be Baptist when the '80s, you know, so I'm like, it's like the same, but even still I questioned like, you know, I even questioned like, do I want to be a Christian? I mean, you know, at some point of life. Right. And then we have this thing about you make it your own and you choose it yourself. Mm-hmm. That's not existent here. There's no make it your own and choose it yourself. So that's just a dynamic that's real. Mm. But God, we go to a local church here and that's the past several years. So we've been able to see, you know, when you live somewhere, you know this, when you live in a place for, you know, 12 years at a time, you see some of the shifting and changing happening, like at the bigger picture. So I've definitely seen, and God is completely on the move and doing something. It's nowhere near a pace that, you know, would be what I would choose. But obviously that's probably why I'm not the one choosing it. So, but definitely there's people who are coming to faith, specifically in the Buddhist faith, actually right now, a lot of first generation believers who are being baptized. We had a baptism, I think we do them quarterly right now. And just my church, which is just, you know, it's not like a mega church or anything.
Yeah.
I think we just baptized like 48 people.
Wow.
Yeah. Last
month. That's amazing.
It was the longest baptism. It was almost like boring. It was like, I'm sitting here thinking, I'm sorry, God, why did I just say that was boring? Cause it's hot. Right. But you know, seriously, like, I can't believe I even thought this was boring because like, I like live for this stuff. Right.
Yeah. I would love to hear, just wrapping up, what have been the greatest joys for you in these 12 years in Malaysia?
Oh yeah. Lots of highs. So I think just like some things in the business that have been really awesome was when we got this contract to produce for Raven and Lily, which is this US based fair trade company that's sold a lot of places. Because we were like nobody. That was literally at the time we were working in my house and the founder came out and I was a bit like, she's going to laugh at me when she sees all this, you know? And she was such an encouragement and we've learned so much from that partnership and I'll be forever thankful to them for just learning how to do all of this. And they were very supportive of us as an artisan group and all with them. So that's huge highlight. We made really beautiful things with them. Like we've always like with the apparels and we learned how to do natural dye and things like we've really, so we, our skill set has just massively taken off because of that partnership. So that is super highlight for me. Like everybody's dream, whoever works in fashion in Malaysia, is to like sell it internationally. Also in places like America or London, you know, it's kind of like very cliche. So the fact that we're like these women in the ghetto, you know, pumping out like eco dye, 100% silk dresses sold, you know, for $300 in America is like awesome. Like, I just feel like that's significant for where these women come from, having dignity and honor and like, and we show them all the pictures, you know, like, look, there's a supermodel wearing this.
Wow.
So that's huge, right? Like in, professionally. Yeah, we've worked with big companies like Starbucks and the Uber of this region and been in Malaysia Airlines magazines and all. So those kind of things are like very significant because of the story of who we're working with. Yeah. And then I think, I mean, personally for me, it's obviously just, I have three amazing kids and this, I have this really wonderful life that my kids are getting to be third culture kids who just know diversity and God. Their minds are just so much bigger. Their mindsets are so much bigger than anything I ever had growing up. And they don't even have a clue like how awesome their life is. But you know, it's got its own struggles too, right? But that's a highlight. And then, yeah, this one day I've seen one friend in all of this time come to faith. And that was got to be highlight because it happened one night in my living room. She came over and she said, I need to meet you tonight. And I was like, okay, come on over. And she showed up and she started telling me this story about this man and she wants to know him. And I was like, who is it? I thought she like needed a boyfriend or something. And then she started telling me this and I was catching on. I was like, I think this is Jesus she's talking about. And then she said to me, and she had no, this girl has no context of the Bible, never been, I mean, so just try to even get your head around this. Like never in her 20 something years of life, like, heard anything about the gospel, much less anything from the Bible. She's never even seen a Bible in her life. And she says to me, it's like I need some kind of armor. And I was like, oh, we have that, you know? And then, so I was able to take the scripture in her local language and be able to read about, you put on the armor of God, and this is what it is. And so she knew. So God, that is a huge highlight for me, because it reminded me of what I just said. God can do all things. Like, he can do anything. And he can tell a girl who's never read the Bible that she needs armor. And he told her where to come find it. Like, go to Amy's house. She will tell you where to get the armor. And I, and like, she just showed up and asked me for it. And I'm like, huh? You know, I mean, like, yeah, I wish that was happening every day.
I know.
But yeah, that's probably my other highlight, which is seeing the power of God, like, be able to speak to someone who had no religious, like, background from that.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense knowing y'all. I mean, I haven't talked to you in many years, but knowing Ryan from high school and knowing you guys from college and all those years, it makes sense where you are. I just think it's really cool to see the trajectory of someone's life and to see the things that they were passionate about, the things you guys were passionate about when you were younger, that God has directed your steps and put those passions together with opportunities, and you're being faithful to take them. I love that.
Yeah. It's cool. It's cool to see how God weaves in our life, isn't it?
Yes. So where can we, I'm sure people are now wondering, we want to see this stuff that you're making. How can we connect with your boutique?
Yeah. So we ship internationally, and actually most of our products are available shipping from the U.S. We offer free shipping if you purchase in the U.S. So we try to make it as easy as possible. So you, if you're in America, you can purchase online at www.thebatikboutique.com. So it's thebatikboutique.com. And then all of our, we love when you follow us on social media, like especially Instagram and Facebook. We share, like, on our Instagram stories, we'll put, like, you know, the women, like the unedited versions of things. So if you want to really follow the story of us on Instagram and Facebook, both of our handles are also the Batik Boutique.
And it's spelled B-A-T-I-K.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, we'll definitely, I'll put links to all that in the show notes and on my website for anybody who wants to connect with Amy and her artisans in Malaysia. It's so exciting what God's doing. And I'm thankful for your time today, Amy.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Christine.
I encourage you to check out the Batik Boutique online and on Instagram, and hopefully find a few products that you can buy that will help children and women in Malaysia continue to learn skills that give them dignity and a future. I have linked to the online store in my show notes, so go check that out. Friends, I want to let you know that this season of By Faith will wrap up in mid-June with an Ask Me Anything episode. I've invited my husband Kyle to join me, and together we will be answering any questions you have for us. And when I say anything, I mean anything. We will answer questions related to this season's theme of serving by faith, but we'll also tackle any questions you want to throw our way. So submit your questions at the link in the show notes or through the link in my Instagram profile, which is ChristineHoover98. I can't wait to see what you have for us to answer. Join me next week as I talk with Lauren Weir. Lauren is a mom of a toddler and a newborn. She also writes and counsels young women in her home, consistently pointing young women back to Jesus. Lauren shares with us what servanthood is and how she's practicing that in everyday ways out of her home. I know you're going to love hearing from her. Until then, have a great week and keep walking forward by faith.